you know, what really excites me, I mean, I'm not actually excited by these multi-core things. Well, I am, but not the Intel model. I mean, Intel says, okay, let's just do a Pentium core twice. That's not very exciting, or four times, or eight times, because it's still the same old architecture, and it hasn't addressed the message passing problem. The thing that's really interesting are the network-on-chip architectures. You know, the Tilera Tile 64, and it's just about the only one that's on the market. I haven't got my hands on it yet, but this is just a switch matrix with a regular load of chips in it. Now, Intel did this Polaris chip with 80 CPUs, And I read some, I don't know if it's true, but they said it did a teraflop. Now, a teraflop in 2006 on a single chip, 50 watts, that's really exciting. Because prior to that, I mean, if you go back in history, the ASCII Red in 1996 got to a teraflop. And it was 9,600 Intel Xeon processors. It took a megawatt of power and 2,400 square feet of floor space. Right? So if we can fabricate thousands of chips on one substrate, we can't do it with these whacking great big Pentiums. And we need to think about the messaging infrastructure. So when you build this regular switching structure, I don't know what it is, a dual DDR3 bus or something, and then regular processors here, then, as I say, suppose you've got 1,000 chips on an FPGA. The FPGA runs at 400 megahertz. Mm-hmm. You're doing 400 giga instructions per second. And if you can't do something useful with that, you know, you might as well give up and go home. I mean, when we're talking about tera, the other thing's going to happen, petabyte memories, terabytes, tera instructions per second. But and that's going to hit us within 10 years. Wow. I mean, they usually say that the gap, I was talking to Hardware Guy, the gap between the performance of a supercomputer and the desktop is 6 years. You know, so we're going to have petabytes of memory possibly in 10 years. We're going to have teraflops of performance on single chips running at 20 watts within 10 years.
So, but Joe, do you think that there's so much kind of parallelism available in kind of algorithms? So suppose I write, you know, Word, right? Do you think there's... But that's kind of, you know, an application that people use, right? But is there enough inherent parallelism in there to kind of, you know, keep all these processors busy? And if there is, you know, how do we express, you know, the computation to do that?
I think it just opens up a new class of problems, because the thing that the computer, that we are good at doing and the computer can't do is visual processing. I mean, the eye and the pre-visual cortex of the brain is a massively parallel computer. We imagine doing scene analysis. The first step is you have to do edge detection and surface detection and modelling and, you know, things like face recognition, computers can't understand pictures and classify them. They can't recognise faces and things like that. Well, they're beginning to do that, but this requires massive amounts of computational power. You want to do computational chemistry, protein folding, or, I mean, you know, you connect all the computers in the world to find a protein that has certain combinatorial possibilities. It folds in a certain way so we can use it for cancer. Okay, so we've got to get 1 million computers and run them for a year. So now we do it on one computer in 5 seconds. You know, so I'm sure that's good. I don't think people's imagination has stopped finding new problems as these technologies become available. You know, so I think it's going to be very exciting. But I don't see this with the traditional architecture. It needs an architectural change. Because we can't fabricate 1 million processors on one chip with a sort of... It's not going to be 1 million Pentium processors that run old 8386 code. It's going to be 1 million tiny little FPGAs or something, you know, running ASCII or Erlang. Or hey, maybe it's some of these chips are running Erlang, some of them are running ASCII, some of them are running OCaml, some of them are running different operating systems. Maybe we're using an FPGA dynamically recompiling the hardware as we go along. You know, nobody knows how to do this, but it's good news for software people because it's job security. You know, for you and I, it's it's good fun.
Yeah. They'll sometimes.
So, what do you think? Am I right or am I right?
Well, so, you know, I think you're right, but what scares me a little bit is, like, you know, how can we express our algorithms to kind of really kind of, you know, take care of this parallelism, right? Because, and how do we, you know, distribute the computation over these machines? And And how do you parameterize it? Like, you know, if I have, like, you know, 40 processors or 400, you know, how do I configure all these things? So, as you say, it's job security. It's like a lot of unsolved problems.
Yes.
But it's like asking, you see, the Erlang model of computation is very much like the postal service. So, if you say, I want a trillion volunteers who will solve problems, put out your hand, and you say, well, you give me your address here. And so, how do you formulate a problem? You write it on a sheet of paper, you put it in the envelope, and you post it to somebody. And they say, please solve this problem and send a reply to this guy. So if you want to make that fault tolerant, that's easy. You write 100 envelopes. If 100's not good enough, you write 1,000 or 1,000,000. It doesn't really matter. You know, redundancy doesn't matter. And maybe the next problem will be, well, if the letter says, please solve this problem and reply to this guy, they're only replying to one guy, so if that one guy drops dead, tough. Okay, so please solve this problem and reply to these 100 people, or these 1,000 people, or something. So if you can solve your problem thinking in such terms, can I solve the problem by sending letters to people with instructions as to what they're doing? Then you can solve your problem. And you have to solve your problem that way if you've got a big system. I think Google, I don't know how many computers they got, I read 450,000. There's no way you can structure, you know, ideas of just synchronously changing the software in that system or of solving problems without this kind of lazy message passing, live with errors and modify as you're going along. Without that view of the world, you're just not going to be able to build big systems. And I don't think it's difficult. I mean, people behave like this. We send letters to each other. We send email. We used to send letters.
But a letter is an object, right?
A letter's a container that delivers stuff to somebody. Now we're talking using IP voice graphs fly across the air. Full messages.
So, I mean, what about the... A lot of times it seems to me in this conversation, and granted, you guys are software pioneer types, what about the hardware people? Don't they have any role to play in making it sort of a reasonable task for you guys to come up with reasonable problems?
You know, we're behind them, actually.
So they're years ahead of us.
Yeah.
But do they?
I mean, we're just realizing what they've invented years ago. I mean, this. Well, the paper in 2000 was called The End of the Road for Instruction Level Parallelism, predicted this effect that would run out of instruction level parallelism. It occurred in 2002. And then in about, you know, the hardware guys said, well, you're all going to have to get used to doing concurrent programming on multi-cores. And they were saying that in 2003. We're waking up. When do we wake up? When the dual cores come on the laptops in the shops. You know, so that's 5 years after the hardware guys have first done this stuff. Mm-hmm. So I think the software community is lagging behind. But look at FPGAs. I mean, they're a typical thing which hasn't caught on in software. But
what are those, for those who don't know?
Field programmable gate arrays. This is amorphous hardware. You can program the hardware to do new things. So, for example, if you want a sorting algorithm, you say to the hardware, become sorting hardware.
Wow.
And it becomes sorting hardware. You know about FPGAs.
Yes,
we all know about FPGAs, but when I first looked at FPGAs about 5 years ago, they were very expensive. The development kits were very expensive. The only people who knew how to program were hardware guys, and they didn't have many logical elements on them. And the position is radically different now. I got looking at a problem a while back, and that was how to write a parser. And somebody said, well, should we write this parser in Erlang or C++? And I did a little bit of research there, and I thought to myself, wait a moment, the choice of technology when you solve a problem determines the final answer. So I don't need to, by choosing Erlang or Haskell or C++, I have made an implicit decision about how fast that will go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then I looked in the research and it said, an FPGA, a parser for XML in FPGA goes 3,000 times faster than C++. And I thought to myself, we're mad. Why are we writing software? You know, given the answer, it's like these, you know, these Russian physicists, when the Americans had made an H-bomb, they knew it was possible. They didn't have to be told how to do it. They knew it was possible. So I now know that it's possible to do a parser in an FPGA that's 3,000 times faster than C++. So why should I be interested in using software to solve problems like parsing? There is no logical reason. There is no logical reason.
Hmm.
So what we're seeing, the latest, Altera I think it's Altera, they make the big FPGAs, they can blow a NIOS core in 1,200 logical elements. That's roughly a MIPS processor. And the latest chips are going to have 340,000 logical elements on. Right. Mm-hmm. So the notion of a microprocessor, this is a little bit of software that we put onto the hardware. So you want, if your application's got 50 processes, let's just make a chip that's got 50 processes. It runs the application. A second later, we need 200 processes. Okay, let's blow 200 processes onto the chip and dynamically reconfigure it as we're going along. This is very beautiful.
So Satnam Singh in Microsoft Cambridge, Microsoft Research Cambridge, is using Haskell and F-sharp specifically to kind of program FPGAs, and he's been doing this for years using functional programming to do that. So
is this the jar, what's it called? Lava.
Lava, yeah. Yes.
How's that coming along?
Oh, yes, he's doing great stuff. The last time I was there, he did kind of, you know, vision kind of, you know.
And, it's very exciting. You know,
yes, very, very nice. And again, this
is. Do you share my belief that this is where we're going?
Oh, yes, definitely. And again, it's for exactly the same reasons that you say. It's like these things have, you know, enormous computing power, and you just kind of, you blow these things on there, and you can dynamically reconfigure them.
Okay, but so let's step back out to, you know, like where somebody like myself or others who live in, you know, creating applications that get used by business or whatever, and we don't live down at that level. So how are you going to abstract to me some sort of contacts that I can make things happen? And so when you say, well, just create more processors if you need them, I mean, what would that look like in for a professional developer who lives up in user mode?
We don't know. That's what's fun about it.
But the language,
we have ideas, of course.
But the language could be C#, could be Java.
We don't know.
We don't know.
We don't know. We don't know. Because it's all very new with us. It's very exciting, actually.
It is. Very interesting.
You know, hello, people out there, get some FPGAs.
Yeah.
Good tip.
And learn Erlang.
Yeah, Haskell. Learn Erlang and Haskell.
So I want to ask you guys, I want to step a little bit into the languages now, because Haskell, Erlang. Can you talk just briefly about, like, what are some of the fundamental constructs in your languages? So where are they similar? Where are they different? I mean, we've been talking a lot about functional.
Right,
but
so it's false. It's where you put the emphasis. I think Erlang is a language whose the primary thing about Erlang is that it's concurrent. So the Erlang model of the world is black boxes that communicate by sending messages, and they perform computations inside black boxes. So in a sense, I don't really care if how I perform the computation is functional or imperative or anything like that. So the emphasis is on the concurrency.
Yes.
And then that we happen to have a functional programming language inside the black box, that's a secondary concern. I think in your world, that's the primary concern.
Yes.
And you're not concerned about concurrency. So I don't know if that.
Yes. So the idea in Haskell is that everything is a function. So the only values really that you have are functions. And of course, you know, for efficiency, you know, you have like numbers and so on. But really, you don't need them. So you could do everything with functions. So that's kind of the idea of the language. And once you take that, you know, there's a lot of nice properties that you have.
Okay.
And I think in similar way, the way I look at Erlang is the way you say everything is a process. And once you have that abstraction, it becomes very powerful, because that now becomes your building blocks. And then, as Joe said, within each process, you know, there's some computation that needs to be done. And at some point, you know, that's probably an imperative program. But theoretically, you could do even, you know, everything could be a process down to the kind of,
the point at which we agree is this absence of side effects in how we perform computations.
Yes.
And that enables, in my world, it's not there. I mean, the reason it says not for mathematical purity, it's there for pragmatic reasons. It turns out to be the easiest way to write things, and it turns out how a good way to, if we get rid of the side effects, it turns out to be a good way to eliminate errors. So what we agree on is the absence of side effects. Then, you know, you hear like a sort of false argument that we disagree over dynamic types or static types. And that's kind of the arguments within the church. How do we interpret lambda calculus? You know, the lambda calculus is up there.
Yep.
And well, how do you interpret that?
Well, as a dynamically typed system with the lambda calculus doesn't say anything about types. That's the typed lambda calculus. It says about the absence of side effects. And we all agree about that.
Yep.
Pure functions which don't have side effects. whether we have lazy evaluation or eager evaluation, or whether it's a static type system or a dynamic type system, that's inter-church argument, you know. And you know, for the people outside, the community outside, to think that, that's important. That's what we argue about when we're at a conference.
Exactly.
But,
sure,
but we have a united front against the world, that this is in general a good thing to do.
Yeah.
You know, and side effects, we would both agree, you know, that in Java, you know, we learned at school that side effects were bad. So to me, hiding the side effect inside an object where you can't even see them, it's like, you know, that's like the devil itself. You know, this is not how to program.
Interesting. Yeah. So one important reason why side effects are kind of, you know, undesirable, mm-hmm, is that they break compositionality. We talked about this before, right? If there's no side effects, I can reason about the different components of my system independently because I know that they don't influence each other. Mm-hmm. And you know, that allows you to break a big problem into smaller problems that you can solve independently or execute independently.
Yes.
And so, and then the communication becomes explicit. So it's, you have to be mindful how things interact instead of with side effects where it's invisible how things interact. Mm-hmm. So, and then you can get kind of strange, you know, distortions because, you know, some things happen, but you cannot see where, you know, where these things interact. So we make the kind of interaction visible because that's important. That's a detail we don't want to abstract from.
Now, what about when exceptions happen and one of these little tentacles that are running way over here and could actually have side effects?
No.
No, the answer is no.
No, like, no way.
The answer is, I mean, 42.
Of course, one of the other benefits, which Eric didn't mention, is we have functional programming have single assignment. Okay. Assign once variables. I mean, that means that once you've assigned a value to a variable, say let x equal something in, then x can't change its value. Now, this is the thought change that people find difficult. Mm. So the beginners say, you know, you can't write x equals x plus 1. In Haskell, and you can't write it in Erlang, and you can't write it in OCaml. You have to invent a new variable. You have to say x1 equals x plus 1. Now, that might sound silly, but it has profound consequences for things like debugging, because if you can say x equals a new value of x, and you're in a loop, and this value of x is floating around all your code, changing its time all over the place, at some point in your program, it's got the wrong value. And you say, hey, wait a moment, x is 42 here, and I'd expected it to be 7. But hang on, I've changed it 10,000 times in 400 different subroutines. Very difficult to find out what it is. So you need a debugger to find out where it happened. Well, Erlang, really easy, because it's been assigned its value once, and it keeps that value forever. So if it's got the value 42 and it's wrong, there's only one place where it can have happened. That's very easy to track down. So debugging systems, we don't have debuggers and things. That's because we don't need them. You know, people don't sit in debuggers for hours. I don't have a debugger. The sort of errors that can happen
are very different.
Are very different.
So funny that you use this example of x equals x plus 1. Uh-huh. Because the reason that I, you know, decided to study computer science was exactly because a friend showed me a Visual Basic or a basic program on the TRS-80 or something. And it was like, you know, let x equals x plus 1. And I said, that's impossible. How can x be equal to x plus 1? Yeah. So then I decided to do computer science. And now I know that it's, you know, that it's the wrong thing to do that.
That it's side effectful.
No, that it's side effectful, yes.
Because variables in Erlang and Haskell behave like variables in mathematics.
Yes.
We say, if you hadn't learned some stupid language that tells you that they're different to maths, you can just take over all that you learned in your maths lessons and apply them to computing.
Yes.
It's some, you know, I remember learning Fortran, and the first time they said x equals x plus 1 or something, I went, hey, no, my maths teacher told me you're not allowed to do that, because, you know, I tell my kids, I help them with maths, I say, you know, there's an equation, 7x plus 3y equals 2x plus 6, solve this equation. It means the same value of x on both sides of the equation. And it does in Haskell, it does in Erlang, but it doesn't in C or Java or something. You know, it's got some weird semantics that makes it really difficult to understand. But we brainwash people. We tell them when they start to learn programming that the variables in programming are not like the variables you learned in maths. And they find it difficult to accept. Usually their first reaction is, hey, this doesn't make sense. Then they accept it. And then we come along and say, you can't change them. And they say, well, that's difficult. But hang on, forget. I think if we took kids straight after they've done their math lessons and taught them Erlang or OCaml or something, they would find it a lot easier.
Yes. Yeah.
interesting.
Yeah. And I think one of the things is that you get really influenced by the first programming language that you learn. That, in some sense, you know, I don't know, your brain changes. And if you have started to learn programming in an imperative language, it's really hard to unlearn. So I think, you know, what Joe is saying is that if we would teach people functional programming right from the start,
sure,
I think, you know, a lot of, you know, it would find a lot more acceptance.
Sure. But it is a, it is, it is a sort of a dramatic change.
No.
To go from imperative.
Well, yes, to go from imperative.
And then to say that objects
aren't. To go from what you learned in maths at school to this program.
True. Absolutely correct. Yeah. But we have been taught the beauty and power of objects. And
right, so if the human wonderful race, if the human race sort of lasts for, you know, if there's no global crisis that wipes us all out, we're talking about...
But that's shared state.
We're talking about this little millimeter global of time when we were kind of sorting out how to fix programming language, because it's really early days still.
Yeah,
you know, very and early days. So if the early programming language made the odd mistake, sure, you know, we fixed that up
let's
now.
Fix it.
Yeah, let's fix it.
So now what about the notion of another sort of a important part of object-oriented programming is the way that you can build shareable functionality. So I can build a class and throw it over the wall to Eric and he can use it. So you call that modularization or componentization.
Yes.
So in the so there are those who argue that software engineering is not an engineering discipline because it's not composable. And so if I want to change, if I want to redesign my kitchen, I have to knock my house down and then rebuild my house and rebuild my kitchen. That's the way that software is made today, because it's not composable. It really isn't componentized to the extent that you can just replace things. How does that work in your languages?
It works very nice.
Huh?
It works very nice. I mean, I think I read somewhere, I love this analogy. Just, the problem with object-oriented programming is you wanted the banana. But you didn't just get the banana. You got the gorilla who was holding the banana and the entire jungle. So you can't just take this, you know, here I've got an object that does what I want, and I want to use it in a completely different context. You can't just lift this thing out and use it over there, because you get the whole jungle as well. It doesn't really work. Now, in Erlang, everything are very small functions, and we can just reuse them, we can pipe them together, we can do things. So I have always believed that binding together data structures with the functions that work on them is a fundamental mistake, because data structures have no behavior. They are purely declarative. They're a type. Functions are things which change data structures, and locking them together in some arbitrary combination seems to be lunacy. And the fact we can compose things is because we can take our data structures and we can write new functions, and we can call these functions in little chains, or we can pipe them together through processes, and they're composable.
Wow. So when are you going to start redoing C# and make it completely functional, Eric? I'm just kidding. But it is interesting. I mean, you were going to say something before I asked that silly question.
Okay, no, that's really not a silly question. So, because I believe that, you know, there you have to have this kind of transition, right? I don't think, you know, even though how much I wanted to do that, but it's impossible to kind of, you know, throw away everything that exists, right? So what I'm trying to do is trying to get these ideas from functional languages into these kind of mainstream languages. And then people like Joe now with Joe Armstrong, with Erlang, you know, that's the, and F#, and so there will be a whole wave of new and really old languages, and now people will be familiar. Oh, you know, having functions, lambda expressions, I know that from C#. Oh, now, so the transition to kind of more pure languages will be easier. So I'm just trying to smooth the path for, you know, to kind of, and I don't believe in kind of radical change. I believe that a radical change is needed, but I think the most efficient way to get there is to kind of just prepare people for that. And at some point, you know, I think we will kind of all switch over. That's definitely
interesting.
Yeah. But I find it very strange, the idea that Java or C++ or Haskell or Erlang should be, you know, the ultimate language, and that we'll have all this legacy and we'll never change thereafter. What I believe is that, you know, languages take a little bit of time to mature. You know, the ideas take a bit of time to sink in. Some of the ideas are good, others are bad. And then when the next generation of language designers come along, they're going to look at Erlang, they're going to look at Haskell. I mean, I suppose we do something like Erlang over again. We'll do Java plus plus, or Haskell plus plus, C C plus plus,
C sharp,
C quadra plus, or whatever it's going to be called. So what I'm going to say is, so what are the good ideas from Erlang? Well, this pure message passing, this isolation process is a very lightweight process. That's a good idea. The bit syntax is a good idea. The dynamic type system, well, maybe the strong type system in Haskell is a good idea. That's you see, language design isn't, I don't know, it's like going into a big sweet shop. And, you know, if you're a language designer, you go into the sweet shop and there's all sorts of sweeties, and you choose. And you can't really say... You can't say that Erlang's good or bad. You can't say that Haskell's good or bad. You can say, has the language designer chosen from this basket of sweeties a sort of collection of things that sort of makes sense, sort of hangs together? And what we're doing, we're making sweeties for the next generation of language designers. How they use those sweeties, I don't know. But we're not going to have Java forever. We're not going to have Haskell forever. We're not going to have Erlang forever. Uh-huh. You know, it'd be rather depressing if it were. I mean, we would be the last language designers. Yes. And, you know, that wouldn't be fun.
Certainly.
We have benefited from, you know, Niklas Wirth and the great language, you know, Tony Hoare, people like that. We've read what they've done, and we've made our own little contributions on top of that. You know, we haven't invented all this stuff. I've sort of pick and choose from good stuff. And it's not just me. There's a lot of other people who've done that.
No, I agree with you.
That's good to carry on.
We're a little bit like chefs, or, you know, we're making pizzas, and you have to kind of tastefully arrange the ingredients and to make something that's kind of useful and nice and healthy and so on. Mm-hmm. So
don't want to eat the same pizza forever.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, and now it's like, you know, kind of removing a little bit of the emphasis on side effects and so on. It's like, you know, removing, what is it, partially hydrated fats or something from the diet, and, you know, and making it slightly more healthy.
Now, let me ask you this, because this is interesting. I mean, since you used the pizza analogy, it could be that one day you had a little bit too much wine when you're making the pizza, and you knock over some pineapple that falls onto it, and you throw it in the oven and taste it, like, wow, it's actually not as bad as I thought it would be. Mistakes or unexpected things happen and you add it to your language. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. I mean, that happens a lot. Like, for example, in C#, did you guys really, when you created Link, were you really thinking about multi-core? You were really thinking about the problem at hand, not, let's talk about that.
Okay, so, again, you know, I cannot speak for the others, but since, you know, my background, since I know where I came from, definitely... had that in mind. And you can see this, for example, in Visual Basic, where in the syntax for queries, we have support for aggregation. Because if you look at a lot of these, the ways you express these problems, you know, on kind of, you know, data parallelism, they're all of the form you kind of, you know, map, you kind of, you know, perform some operation on all values, and then you group them, and then you aggregate the result into kind of, and this is exactly supported by the syntax with this in mind specifically. So yes, in my case, I cannot talk about the other language designers, but yes.
Cool. Now, in the case of Erlang, you obviously said you had concurrency in your mind from the beginning. Now, if you when you wrote it, you only had one core.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't necessarily be faster than something written in C++.
Yeah.
Now, let's talk about that, though, because you wouldn't be able to decompose the operations in target cores. You only have one, right?
So the reason for the way it's architectured is for fault tolerance, not for concurrency.
Yes, got it. Okay.
Because, you know, when I give a lecture...
No side effects?
No, not at all.
Okay.
The fault tolerance needs two computers, right? You can't do fault tolerance on one computer, it might crash. So this is really funny because, you know, these things that you know, and they're so obvious that you never bother to tell anybody. So this was one of the things. I suddenly realised that I had in my head that fault tolerance systems have two computers, because if one crashes... And a lot of people thought you could make fault-tolerant systems with one computer. Because they're thinking about try, catch, you know, how do we program all this stuff? And I'm thinking about, wait a moment, the whole computer crashes. That's a different way of thinking about the world. So something I realized, when I say fault-tolerance, I mean the whole computer crashes, and I want the service to be there. When people were receiving the words fault-tolerance, they were thinking, how do I do try, catch, you know, handle exception? But they weren't thinking of the case where you pull the plug out and the whole thing crashes. So my starting point was, let's have two computers. That's why we copy everything. Because, you know, it's crashed. Sorry. You're kind of dangling pointers. when you make a fault-tolerant system, you know, here's computer 1, computer 2, you have to copy everything you need to recover from computer 1 to copy to computer 2. That's the pure message passing model. Now, at the time, this was done for fault tolerance. It wasn't done for concurrency. Now, it turns out if these two computers are on two cores on the same processor, because we've copied all the data, these two processors can run in parallel with no locks. So the fact that it's a very good language for multicore is an accidental side effect of the design. Uh-huh. It wasn't intended to be for multicore. We didn't dream of multicore. So.
Interesting.
So can you talk a little bit about the history of Erlang, right? Because it started out as a logic programming language, is that correct? Early days?
It didn't start out as a language at all. It started out as a sequence of experiments. Because I worked for Ericsson Computer Science Lab, and it started out as... We just wanted to find a better way of programming telephony. So, you know, at the time we interpreted computer science as, let's program telephony in every language that will run on a VAX 11750. My definition of computer science is program on a VAX 11750, which is free. And so we programmed it in Ada and Concurrent Euclid, and there were four or five of us, and we just chose a language, small talk. And of all the ways I programmed it, I liked Prolog best. I thought Prolog was very nice. But Prolog had no concurrency. So I added, processes to Prolog. It's quite easy to do because Prolog is so easy to write a meta-interpreter. I just wrote a meta-interpreter that supported concurrency. And there was no thought in my head that I was designing a programming language when I did that. And then we added things to it. And then one day I think, hey, it sort of got a name somehow. I don't even know how it got a name. And it wasn't. And Erlang was just what Joe was doing. So what is Erlang? It's what Joe's working on. And after about a year, you know, I'd been working on it alone, then another guy came along, Robert Vierding, and he worked on it, and he said, you know, do you mind if I just change a bit of your code? And that, when Robert says that, it means that, you know, about a week later, you know, there was a comment at the start that said, Joe started this, and all the code had completely changed, and Robert had rewritten everything. And we muddled along for another year, and we actually got some interest from some product people. They wanted to make a product in it. But up to that point, we were changing the language on a daily basis. We put stuff in which we thought was a good idea, and they tried it out, and they said, we don't like this, so we took it out. But it wasn't religious, it was pragmatic. And Mike Williams came along, and we built an abstract machine, rather like the JVM, only earlier. It got faster, and it was incremental all the time. It wasn't. The grand plan was to make a programming language. There was never that idea. It sort of froze, and another guy, Bogdan Hausman, came along and did a register machine for it. Uppsala University did a JIT compiler and this kind of stuff. Got more users.
So is it...
It was evolution all the time.
Yeah. Is it a terse language?
Yeah.
Very terse.
Yeah.
Okay.
Actually, it's usually shorter than Haskell.
Yes? Yes.
That's because of the dynamic
but
type
system.
But
is it faster than Haskell? Same program.
It depends on the problem.
X equals X plus 1.
That doesn't
make sense. Can't do that.
Trick question.
Raises an exception.
Yeah, so let Y equal X plus 1, right? Or whatever.
Actually, no, it's different, you see. If we do it, it raises an exception.
You do it with the type error. Zero seconds to execute.
Excellent.
Yes, it can't happen.
Beautiful. Well, I've taken a lot of your time, and I really, really appreciate it. This has been incredibly fascinating. I look forward to talking to you both again sometime.
Yes, and thanks a lot, Joe. And really, everybody should buy Joe's book. I mean,
thank you.
It's really good. I took it here in the plane. I have it in my hotel room every night, and reading the next chapter.
If you look at that book and look at the audience I was addressing, I want you to write Haskell books like that as well.
I would love to.
Well, maybe not you personally.
Yes. I'm too busy,
in the product thing. Well, Simon should find the time then, right? He's a researcher. Come on, he's lounging on the beach.
Researchers are busy too. There is. I think there are people writing a book on Haskell. I forgot. There's. I think two people. I think for O'Reilly.
Okay. So I think there are several books.
Yes. So and there's and so
the publishers have been kind of chasing us up.
Exactly. So there's demand. It will come.
Yeah.
Cool. And it'll be interesting to see what happens next year at this conference if you're both here.
Yeah.
Maybe some crazy thing has been concocted by them. We're writing imperative and functional at the same time. We love it. All right. Take
care.
Thank
you. Yes.